This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, thousands remain without water and power in Gaza 1 month after Israel's attacks. Palestinians from the Jordan Valley, who were expelled when the Israeli military declared their lands a firing zone during the Gaza attacks, remain uprooted. A ghost town is brought back to life through architectural preservation programs in Hebron, and news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, including an interview with Josh Rubner of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation on the many victories of 2012 and upcoming strategies for many more in 2013.
BDS is not just a mantra, it's not just words to live by, but it's actually a strategy that's having an impact upon institutions.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor for the Electronic Intifada in Berkeley. We begin with the Gaza Strip in the aftermath of Israel's 8 consecutive days of bombings in mid-November, which killed more than 170 persons, including 30 children. In a report published on the Electronic Intifada last week, Eva Bartlett writes that initial estimates of the damages incurred by Israel's attacks are set at $250 million, with another $700 million in indirect damages, according to the Gaza government. Bartlett reports, quote, "The vast destruction has affected bridges, thousands of homes, hundreds of UN shelters, tens of mosques, many government buildings, media offices, financial institutions, hospitals, and health centers, 2 stadiums, a training center for disabled athletes, water and sewage and electricity networks, more than 100 schools, Gaza's lifeline tunnels, and innumerable roads." Israel extensively damaged the electrical network across the Gaza Strip, and Bartlett reports that nearly 40 electrical transformers were damaged or destroyed during Israel's bombings. A spokesperson with Gaza's Electricity Distribution Corporation said that there are still approximately 5,000 persons without power, and that their technicians cannot reconnect them, quote, "because it is still too dangerous to go there despite the ceasefire," end quote. Bartlett adds in her report that Israel targeted water pipelines and reservoirs as well. For more on this story by Eva Bartlett and for much more coverage and analysis of Israel's most recent series of attacks on Gaza, visit electronicintifada.net. During Israel's assaults on Gaza in November, the Israeli military issued more than 40 eviction notices to Palestinian families in the Jordan Valley in the occupied West Bank, bringing tanks and army jeeps to Palestinian land in order to turn it into a firing zone and, quote, "prepare for various security scenarios," according to a report filed by IRIN, the United Nations news agency. The report added that Israeli soldiers threatened the Palestinian families with home demolitions if they did not leave their houses. IRIN's report states that although some Palestinians have been able to return to their homes, others have been told by the Israeli army that they should not come back even though the so-called training exercises are over. The UN's Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs estimates that approximately 5,000 Palestinians, mostly Bedouin and herding communities, live in, quote, "designated firing zones" across the West Bank. These communities are, quote, "among the most vulnerable populations in the West Bank, with little access to services such as healthcare and education, and no basic utilities like electricity and sanitation." That was a report published this week on the Electronic Intifada. For more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, an architectural preservation project is helping to rehabilitate what has been turned into a ghost town in parts of the old city of Hebron. According to a report by Gillian Kessler-Damour, the Hebron Rehabilitation Committee has refurbished some 900 homes in the old city, which has helped return approximately 10,000 Palestinians to the area over the last 15 years. Parts of Hebron's old city has been taken over by approximately 500 Israeli settlers, who are protected by thousands of Israeli soldiers and police. After the mid-1990s, when the settler groups forcibly evicted Palestinian families from the area, The Israeli human rights group Bet Salem estimates that at least 1,000 Palestinian homes were abandoned and 1,800 shops were closed due to increasing Israeli restrictions in the Old City. Kessler Damor reports that, quote, historic buildings have been refurbished and renovated throughout Palestine for decades. Today, entire villages and towns are being rehabilitated. These efforts are seen as a way to insist on the Palestinian character of the area and to maintain Palestine's unique cultural heritage, according to Palestinian architect and planner Iyad Issa. It's part of our history, part of our identity, said Issa, who works with RIWAC, a Ramallah-based center for architectural conservation, adding that rehabilitating buildings provides people with a lasting visual memory and a tangible cultural heritage. That was an excerpt from a report by Gillian Kessler-Damour. For more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. And now we go to news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Ali Abu Nima reported this week that an Israeli-founded cosmetics company, Yes to Carrots, whose products can be found in drugstores across the U.S. and in 24 other countries, has started claiming that their company, with products made under the Yes to brand, is currently headquartered in San Francisco and has no ties to Israel anymore. Abu Nima asks, but how open is Yes to Incorporated really being about its ongoing connections with and manufacturing in Israel? After the Electronic Intifada made inquiries, the company appears to have hidden relevant information from its website that indicates ongoing production in Israeli-controlled territories, including possibly the occupied West Bank. And is the company's effort to downplay its ties to Israel an attempt to avoid a consumer boycott as part of the Palestinian campaign for boycott, divestment, and sanctions? For a full investigation on this story and all other important news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, visit our activism and BDS blog at electronicintifada.net. 2012 was a year of significant victories and strengthening of the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. From Cat Power, Cassandra Wilson, and Zakir Hussain refusing to break the boycott and therefore canceling their performances in Israel, to Stevie Wonder spiking his gig in Los Angeles last month at a benefit for the Israeli army, to multinational corporations losing millions of dollars in contracts because of their ongoing profiteering from Israel's violations of human rights, to student associations worldwide adopting the BDS call and urging their university administrations to divest from companies that do business with Israel, 2012 saw a rise in activism and successes across the globe. So what's in store for 2013? Well, to help us answer this question, we now go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Josh Rubner, the National Advocacy Director of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. Josh, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on your show.
So take us back over 2012. The U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation helped coordinate massive efforts in the BDS movement. How can we assess this growing international activism movement, based on what we've seen in 2012?
Well, I think we saw a number of really significant successes and victories in boycott and divestment organizing in the United States. Perhaps most prominently was the fact that you had two major mainstream Christian Protestant denominations passing boycott resolutions at their annual conferences in 2012, and that was the Presbyterian and the United Methodist Churches. And that was a huge advance, I think, for sort of bringing the concept of BDS into mainstream institutions in the United States. So that there was that. There was also a huge victory in terms of getting TIAA-CREF, which is the nation's largest financial services provider, to divest their stock of Caterpillar as a result of nearly 10 years of organizing BDS campaigns against that corporation for its role in profiteering from Israeli occupation. So these are really important advances, I think, that are showing that BDS is not just a mantra, it's not just words to live by, but it's actually a strategy that's having an impact upon institutions.
Josh, the U.S. campaign is also involved in trying to make headway into changing the entrenched policies that define the U.S.-Israel relationship and alliances. Talk about your work at that level and if we're going to see any significant changes in 2013.
I think it's hard to say, and it's definitely a tougher nut to crack, but in some respects, I'm not troubled by the fact that we haven't yet had significant policy victories in terms of actual shifts in how the United States deals with Israel and the Palestinian people, because, you know, the results of grassroots organizing and social change often only culminate in the policy changes that people hope to see. So I think we're getting to the point as a movement where we need to begin thinking more seriously, thinking more strategically about how do we translate our growing impact to affect boycott divestment victories, to get our points of views across in the mainstream media. How do we translate this growing momentum and growing strength into actually creating some fissures and cracks within this almost uniform wall-to-wall support for Israel that we see coming out of Washington, D.C. So I think we're getting there. We're beginning to get there in terms of building a little bit more access to people in the administration, people in Congress, people in the State Department. We're certainly doing a better job of effectively communicating our points of view to them and delivering petitions that are signed by 10, 20,000 people on specific items, but we haven't yet been able to translate that into tangible policy victories. But I think we'll get there.
It's a long road. And looking towards 2013, which BDS campaigns or policy campaigns should we be specifically watching?
Well, the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation just announced a new competition that we're doing to do a spoof ad of SodaStream, which is, of course, a product made in an Israeli settlement in the West Bank. SodaStream is going on a huge advertising buy. They're doing a Super Bowl ad in February, which is costing them millions of dollars. So it's really a great opportunity to do some spoofing of their product, as we've done of Motorola in the past. So that's in the near term. And, you know, in the more medium term, we'll, of course, continue doing boycott and divestment organizing within churches, on campuses, et cetera.
Excellent. Josh Rubner, you're the National Advocacy Director of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation in Washington, D.C. For much more information on their work, you can go to endtheoccupation.org. And for a roundup of the many BDS victories of 2012, check out our activism and BDS blog on electronicintifada.net. Thank you so much, Josh.
Thank you, Nora.
And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, pointed opinion and analysis, and action alerts by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. This week, check out the arts and culture features and our newest op-eds, plus Abraham Greenhouse's New Year's resolutions for the networked Palestine Solidarity Activist, how IKEA attempts to dodge responsibility for its Israel store's discriminatory delivery practices, how progressive news outlets Alternet and Salon fell for a so-called fatwa hoax peddled by Islamophobes, how the Israeli army uses sex and Instagram to sell its racism and violence, and much more. At electronicintifada.net, you can also post comments and sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and thanks to Flashpoints and KPFA in Berkeley. A big thank you to our listeners who helped us reach our fundraising goal. You make our work possible. Thank you. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.